Summer with Sunil Badami on ABC Local Radio.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a treaty that has just been negotiated or is being negotiated by up to 12 countries. And we've had free trade agreements in the news recently. There was one recently signed with South Korea. And there is also the Abbott government has said that it does want to conclude free trade agreements with China and Japan in the next 12 months. Well, obviously, there are a lot of benefits and opportunities, particularly for exporters and for consumers. On one hand, you know, we are able to be able to export agricultural goods and mining exports to new countries without any tariffs that kind of prevent us from doing so. And on the other hand as well, it also means that we can buy a lot of products a lot cheaper. But there are also dangers. Our guest this morning, Associate Professor Matthew Rimmer, is an expert in intellectual property and copyright law. He's an associate professor at the ANU College of Law and an associate director of the Australian Centre for Intellectual Property in Agriculture. And he received a PhD in law from the University of New South Wales through his dissertation on the Pirate Bazaar, The Social Life of Copyright Law. He's published widely on copyright law and information technology, patent law, biotechnology and access to medicines, clean technologies and traditional knowledge, and written a number of books on these areas. He does have a very particular interest in what's known as intellectual property, and it's great to have you on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Professor Rimmer.
Good Matthew. Morning. How are you going?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for getting up so early.
Oh, that's fine.
Now, as you've mentioned, you know, only about 11% of Australians actually do know anything about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a blockbuster of a trade agreement spanning the Pacific Rim. These days, it's really being pushed heavily by Barack Obama and the United States, but the other negotiating partners include NAFTA countries like Canada and Mexico, a couple of South American countries, Chile and Peru, Australia and New Zealand, Singapore, Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam, and Japan. The agreement is not just a kind of a traditional trade agreement about market access. It covers 29 chapters and it kind of ranges across subjects from intellectual property to e-commerce to matters of public health and tobacco control to questions about investment and competition. Rules in relation to the regulation of financial services. So it's a really big, important agreement. Nonetheless, it's kind of been shrouded in secrecy by the negotiators, which may help explain why only 11% of Aussies know or have heard about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I mean, I guess a lot of kind of government negotiations are secret, but this seems to be especially secret, doesn't it?
Well, it's a kind of a radical level of secrecy in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is quite unusual compared to some of the other international forums that are kind of going on. So, for instance, I've been off to Geneva and I could watch a debate over a copyright treaty in person at the World Intellectual Property Organization. I could see the text and I could see the arguments that were being made. By contrast, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been much more of a process, kind of that has been kind of driven in secrecy. And this has kind of led to a great deal of controversy because while, you know, 600 or so industry advisors and the negotiating parties themselves have access to the text, national parliaments throughout the Pacific Rim have not necessarily been able to see the content of the negotiations. So a lot of politicians in the United States Congress have been very concerned about the secrecy surrounding the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat, who's sometimes kind of touted as a possible runner for the presidency, complained that, you know, for big corporations, trade agreement time is like Christmas morning. They can get special gifts they could never pass through Congress out in public because it's a trade deal, the negotiations are secret, and big corporations can do their work behind closed doors. And her kind of particular view is that, you know, such an agreement, it should be transparent and open, particularly because it could affect such a wide range of different regulatory areas. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership has kind of created real tensions between executives and parliaments throughout the Pacific Rim about transparency in relation to treaty-making process.
Well, it seems strange that you say that, because I happen to look at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade website, and they said that Australia's decision to participate in the TPP in 2008 followed an extensive public consultation process. Overall, there was widespread interest in and support for Australia's participation in the TPP, and input received through the consultation process is being used to inform the government's priorities and objectives for Australia's ongoing work on the TPP. But where was this public consultation process?
Well, I think in terms of the Australian debate, I guess the debate over the Trans-Pacific Partnership has raised a lot of questions about the transparency of treaty making and public participation in that process. I mean, having attended quite a few consultations over the years with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, I would observe that, you know, consultations lack true meaning if you don't have access to the negotiating texts or the positions of the parties. So often some of the consultations have been like an elaborate charade, but it's often a kind of a very asymmetrical level of information. I mean, obviously a range of industry groups, particularly, you know, in the copyright industries, for instance, you know, Hollywood and the record industry, have access to the texts and know what's being pushed and argued, while other entities like civil society groups and political parties and academics don't necessarily have access to those texts. So that's been very controversial. And this year it was particularly controversial because the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade tried to lock out a couple of journalists who wanted to attend one of the so-called public briefings about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this has led to a great deal of controversy in Parliament. So the Australian Labor Party and the Australian Greens passed a motion through the Australian Senate ordering that the coalition government produce documents associated with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The coalition government refused to do so. The Australian Senate at the moment is kind of contemplating what remedies or penalties it will engage in against the coalition government in respect of its refusal to produce documents associated with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Of course, there's a certain irony here because the Australian Labor Party were previously in power while the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership were kind of started and progressed, and while they were in power, they were not necessarily very keen about being open and transparent about the process. But now that they're in opposition, they have decided that openness would be best.
I mean, what's the difference between the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other free trade agreements? Like, say, you know, there's a free trade agreement, you know, in the area with, say, ASEAN countries and with Gulf countries. Why do we need another free trade agreement?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, really, the United States has become very frustrated at the rate of progress in multilateral institutions like the World Trade Organization. So the Obama administration's big trade play has been to try to push for higher standards and obligations in relation to trade agreements through a couple of huge regional deals. So we've already talked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's also another one called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which would cover the European Union and the United States. I guess there have been a lot of critics of such an approach. I mean, some have suggested that such a push for preferential trade deals would lead to a fragmentation of the international trade system. But really, I think, you know, the United States has, you know, a range of tensions with China in particular, has kind of been thinking of regional trade agreements as a means of pushing its way forward if it can't get the cooperation from China in terms of some of the trade bargains that are going on in relation to the World Trade Organization.
You're on Weekend Overnights with me, Sunil Badami, and I'm chatting to Associate Professor Matthew Rimmer about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a huge new free trade agreement between a number of countries in the Pacific Rim that has implications for us in Australia. I mean, but we're already negotiating a free trade agreement. Oh, sorry. What I was going to say was I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call on 1-300-800-222 and let us know what you think about free trade agreements. Do you think that we've got a lot of benefits from them, or do you think we should watch out for them? Are we rushing too fast into negotiating these free trade agreements? As I was saying, Associate Professor Matthew, you know, I mean, the thing is that we're already, the government's committed to negotiating free or concluding free trade agreements with Japan and China this year. So are we trying to hedge our bets by having, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and then going into one with China? Because we've already got a free trade agreement with America, don't we?
Yeah, so in 2004, Australia signed up to a major free trade agreement with the United States, which was kind of quite sweeping in terms of its range. I mean, the new Abbott government have said that they're kind of open for business, and Tony Abbott and his trade minister, Andrew Robb, have said that they're going to aggressively pursue all trade opportunities. And the other week they just did a deal with Korea, the Korea-Australia Free Trade Agreement called CAFTA. I guess the approach of the Abbott government has been interesting in a number of respects. They've become particularly keen on doing deals within a kind of a limited time frame, but very controversially, they've been willing to sign up to investment chapters, so-called investor-state dispute settlement clauses. And these have been kind of very controversial, particularly because Australia has been sued under such an investment clause by Philip Morris, the big tobacco company, who moved to Hong Kong just so they could kind of bring an action under this investor-state dispute settlement system against Australia's regime in relation to plain packaging. So there's been a lot of debate about what are the benefits and risks associated with the coalition government's approach in relation to trade deals.
So it's just coming up to 29 past 4, 29 past 3 in Queensland, and 29 past 1 in Western Australia. So tell me, what is an investor? So basically that means that that companies can sue Australia for reparation.
Yeah, so investor-state dispute settlement clauses really give special rights to foreign investors. So foreign investors could bring an action for compensation or to try to potentially block regulation which would adversely affect their foreign investments. And the system is kind of quite controversial. I mean, there's been a lot of debate about whether such international tribunals really favour complainants, particularly companies, over national governments. But they such clauses have been kind of used, particularly under NAFTA. So Stephen Harper's Canadian government, for instance, has been sued by a US company called Lone Pine over a fracking moratorium.
That's
in
the CSG, the coal seam gas exploration.
Yeah, fracking, hydraulic fracturing. So that's a very interesting kind of dispute, but it's led to a lot of concern about what will be the impact of the investment clause upon agriculture and the environment. And I guess in Australia, the Lock the Gate movement has been particularly active in relation to coal seam gas and coal.
That's the movement by a lot of farmers to kind of prevent, you know, to assert their rights in refusing coal seam gas exploration companies from going onto their property and exploring for gas.
Yes, the Lock the Gate movement has become very active, but their representatives have been particularly concerned about this big investor challenge in Canada over a fracking moratorium. They're concerned that, you know, if state governments in Australia or even the federal government can't put in regulations in respect of fracking, that they could be open for challenge under an investor-state dispute settlement clause. So it's quite an interesting development. And it's not just, I guess, limited to kind of questions of environmental regulation. I mean, there has been another big challenge in Canada by a big pharmaceutical company called Eli Lilly against Canada's drug patent laws. And I guess that particular dispute is of a great deal of concern because that might affect questions about drug pricing and how a national government can take measures to try to protect the health of its citizens. So there's been a lot of concern about whether investment clauses undercut questions of public health. And I guess there's also kind of really interesting questions about foreign investment. So your listeners might remember that there was quite a bit of controversy over a company called Archer Daniels Midland trying to buy up GrainCorp in Australia, and the coalition government kind of rejected that approach. That same company, Archer Daniels Midland, has taken action against Mexico under an investment clause over its agricultural policies. So there's been also a bit of discussion about how an investment clause might affect agriculture and agricultural regulation and how some of the big companies might make use of such clauses. So it's kind of the investment clause has kind of raised a lot of controversy, particularly because there's been a concern that it might undercut public regulation in relation to agriculture and environment and public health and interfere with the ability of national parliaments to engage in lawmaking.
I mean, on one hand, of course, you know, a number of first world countries like Australia, America, the UK, New Zealand and Canada, all, you know, some of their earliest legislation was tariff protection legislation, you know, in terms of putting up tariffs to prevent cheaper imports from flooding the market. And I guess, you know, one of the benefits of a free trade agreement is that we do get access to otherwise protected markets. But does this ISDS, the investment clause, does this kind of remove protections for Australian companies and consumers? And if so, why is the government so eager to sign up to a clause like this?
Sure. The coalition government have a number of justifications in relation to the investment clause. They would argue that such investment clauses could be useful for Australian businesses overseas. So they kind of argue that, you know, for instance, in the deal with Korea, which has an investment clause, or potentially in a deal with the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Pacific Rim countries, you know, Australian companies could take action, particularly if they were concerned that there was not kind of strong rule of law in relation to a legal system. So their argument is that it will provide security for Australian companies in terms of doing business in the Pacific Rim. Andrew Robb, the Trade and Investment Minister, has also really kind of seen investment clauses as a bargaining chip. So as you quite rightly pointed out, very perceptively, you know, Australia is very kind of keen on getting access to major agricultural markets. So Andrew Robb has been of the view that the investment clause perhaps is a good bargaining chip that will help bolster Australia's negotiating position in terms of trying to get market access. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is really kind of interesting in that respect. You know, Japan has joined the negotiations, thus kind of potentially expanding the footprint of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But Japan has been arguing for special treatment across a kind of a half a dozen areas of agriculture, you know, know, including, you know, dairy and rice and beef and... And there's been a great deal of controversy about, you know, whether or not there'll be special treatment for Japan, or whether or not the agreement will be comprehensive in terms of dealing with agriculture, or whether there'll be carve-outs for particular areas. The Korea-Australia Free Trade Agreement had an exclusion of rice, which the Australian rice growers were very concerned about. The Australia-United States Free Trade Agreement famously... still protected the interests of US sugar farmers. So I think it'll be a very kind of challenging negotiation for Andrew Robb in terms of trying to secure access to agricultural markets for Australia and ensuring that it's a true free trade agreement and not just a partial one.
I mean, they're up to about 20 rounds of negotiations and they still haven't kind of negotiated the Doha round of the World Trade Organization talks. I mean, it seems like there's so many different clauses and get-outs and special treatments and stuff like that that you may never even conclude it unless you kind of conclude it quickly.
Yeah, well, it's been quite interesting because WikiLeaks has leaked the intellectual property chapter and another chapter revealing country positions in November 2013. So we have a good idea now of some of the divisions between the negotiating parties and what chapters of the agreement remain particularly contentious and controversial.
Okay, just for anyone who might not be quite au fait with the term intellectual property. What is intellectual property?
Well, intellectual property really refers to a range of regimes that provide for exclusive rights in relation to intangible property. So copyright law provides exclusive rights in relation to cultural works. Patent law provides exclusive rights in relation to scientific inventions. Trademark law provides some exclusive rights in relation to distinctive signs. So the United States in the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been pushing for stronger and longer intellectual property rights to kind of protect some of their flagship technology sectors. So one of the main cheerleaders for the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been Hollywood. I think I caught you earlier in the evening talking about the Avengers and Hawkeye, and you know, Hollywood is very kind of concerned about maximising its copyright protection in relation to films, particularly, you know, blockbuster films like the Avengers. And Hollywood in particular has been pushing for a copyright term extension throughout the Pacific Rim.
Mm. So in the case of someone like a company like, say, Walt Disney, you know, I think at the moment there's kind of a 50 to 60 year time frame from the death of an artist or a creator. And in the case of Walt Disney, you've got this huge company built around characters that were invented a long time ago. So is a company like Walt Disney trying to push for longer copyright?
Yes, Walt Disney is kind of the author, really, of some of the provisions on copyright term in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, the agreement is literally a Mickey Mouse agreement. It's designed to provide longer protection for some of the legacy products of some of the big film companies. So, you know, the standard international level for copyright term is life plus 50 under the Berne Convention and the TRIPS Agreement. The European Union in the 1990s moved to life plus 70. The United States followed suit with the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which was sponsored by Sonny Bono.
That's Cher's husband.
Yes, yes, just before he died in a tragic skiing accident. And Australia in 2004, as part of the Australia-United States Free Trade Agreement, very controversially shifted from life plus 50 up to life plus 70. The Trans-Pacific Partnership kind of pushes even further. The United States is asking life plus 70 for natural persons, but it wants special extra protection in relation to corporate works. So they have been kind of proposing that there should be, you know, 95 years from the end of the calendar year of first publication for corporate works should get current protection. And Mexico has been arguing for life plus 100 years. And really, this is a terrible distortion of copyright law. I mean, copyright protection was always meant to be for limited times. You'd have a limited period of protection, and after that time, the work would fall into the public domain. Copyright term extensions create terrible business uncertainty. In the 1990s, when I was doing my PhD, I had a good chat to the filmmakers who did the film Shine, and they had a dreadful problem because the work of Rachmaninoff came out of the public domain back into copyright protection with the copyright term extension in the European Union. And the poor filmmakers had to deal with all these legal issues associated with the copyright term extension. But there's been a great deal of concern that a copyright term extension would undermine cultural heritage and interfere with the public domain and really stop a wide range of works being able from being produced. And very controversial, particularly in the United States, there were huge constitutional challenges against the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. The Supreme Court of the United States rejected those challenges by a majority, but you had some of the world's leading economists like Ken Arrow and Milton Friedman saying it was a no-brainer to have a copyright term extension. You know, really extending the term of copyright created no new incentive to create new works. It was just a form of corporate welfare. So the copyright term extension and proposal in the Trans-Pacific Partnership is very controversial.
It's 4:43, Weekend Overnights. Give us a call on 1-300-800-222 and share your thoughts. Alex says that investor-state disputes remind me of how Jardine Matheson bullied China into allowing the opium trade in Shanghai and Hong Kong in the 19th century. Give us a call, 1-300-800-222, or text us on 0467-922-702. Now, I'm talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and its implications for Australia and Australian consumers and corporations with Associate Professor Matthew Rimmer from the ANU. Well, I mean, even you've written a book called Hands Off My iPod in terms of the digital copyright and consumer revolution. And I guess that's a particular interest to a lot of Australians. You know, apparently Australia has the record for being the biggest illegal downloader of Game of Thrones, the HBO TV series that's only available to cable subscribers. So what are the implications, for example, in terms of pursuit of people who might download or something like that under the TPP?
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has significant implications for Australian consumers. So Choice Australia, which represents Australian consumers, has been very concerned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and has been running a petition for transparency. But they've also been concerned about how the agreement might affect IT pricing in Australia.
Well, because that's a big thing in Australia, in that you know, we often pay like 10-20% more than people in America.
Yeah, Australian consumers have been ripped off. Australian consumers have been gouged by some of the big IT companies. I appeared before the IT pricing inquiry, and it was really quite shocking how Apple, Adobe, and Microsoft and some of the video games manufacturers and some of the big copyright industries were really charging exorbitant prices in relation to IT products in Australia compared to what they were doing elsewhere.
And it's not even like you have to, you know, pay the postage. You can just download it. So it's not like there are any distribution or packaging costs for the companies, is there?
No. So incredibly controversial. And I guess my concern in terms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that some of the proposals in the agreement would reduce the ability of the Australian government to kind of take action in relation to IT pricing, the so-called Australia tax. So Ed Husic, Australian Labor Party politician, was particularly concerned about IT pricing and tried to name and shame Apple, Adobe and Microsoft. But he was kind of alarmed when WikiLeaks revealed the text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in part because the agreement really strengthens the hand of big IT companies and big copyright companies. So that's very kind of controversial. And there's as you kind of mentioned, there's a huge IP enforcement section in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It really has a discipline and punish model. So it kind of has civil remedies. It proposes a wide range of criminal offences, particularly in relation to copyright piracy and trademark counterfeiting. Also proposes criminal penalties in relation to trade secret theft. Has a range of border and customs measures, and deals with things like seizure of goods, and also has special protections in relation to paid television, which I'm sure Rupert Murdoch would be pleased about.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that it says that the US is fighting for a ban on parallel imports without the permission of the copyright holders, which means that you couldn't buy something cheaply on eBay and ship it here unless a company allows you to do so. Although I should say that Australia and several other countries are opposing the ban. But the scariest thing, I guess, for a lot of people is that Australia is among a minority of countries that are pushing for the criminalisation of copyright infringement that has no direct or indirect motivation of financial gain. So you could kind of download an episode of Game of Thrones, and it could end up leading to criminal penalties. Would those penalties? I know there was a case recently, a few years ago, about a young Australian guy who was kind of sent to.
Hugh Raymond Griffiths was extradited off to the United States and put into jail for being part of a Wears group. But you know, those issues are very important ones in Australia, and I guess the new coalition government have kind of flagged a deep interest in intellectual property enforcement. So the new Attorney General, George Brandis, has dismissed out of hand the Australian Law Reform Commission inquiry in relation to copyright law and fair use. The Australian Law Reform Commission kind of proposed that Australian consumers and citizens should have a defence of fair use like their US counterparts. But Brandis kind of dismissed that out of hand and said that he was very keen on intellectual property enforcement. So in Australia, we have, you know, two possible streams to have, you know, higher levels of enforcement. One through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but otherwise through the potential domestic law reform. And I guess that's very problematic in Australia because we don't have the flexibilities and the latitudes available for our US counterparts. And that's critically important in some of the new technology areas. So I went to a great conference this month at Swinburne University on 3D printing. 3D printing, additive manufacturing is really significant in terms of being potentially the next industrial revolution. You know, 3D printing is used to make a wide range of cultural products and industry goods. But the manufacturers of 3D printing are kind of very nervous about the threat of litigation, particularly in jurisdictions like Australia, which only have a very limited defence of fair dealing rather than an open-ended, flexible defence of fair use. So there's a concern that overprotection of intellectual property might have a chilling effect upon innovation.
Well, we've got Rob on the line. And Rob, tell us, what do you think?
Well, I reckon, guys, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
I reckon, Professor, if I'm not reading you wrong here, I see this as the way that the Yanks can control the world trade around the Pacific. And Mr. Abbott and Mr. Shorten and the Labor Party and Liberals and all the whole bloody lot of them ought to be shot for signing it. It's ruining Australian farming as it is.
I mean, they haven't signed it yet. They're still negotiating on the Trans-Pacific partnership. But, I mean, do you think this is a kind of opportunity for the... I mean, will this benefit the US more than it might benefit, say, Australia or other countries in the partnership?
Well, if you think back, the US signed a free trade agreement with Haiti over rice. Now the Haitians can't sell their rice into the US. The Yanks are pushing their rice into Haiti at a higher price. So I see this purely as a way of the Yanks benefiting themselves, dumping more of their rubbishy products into other countries.
Thanks very much for that, Matt, Rob. Are there benefits to being in free trade agreements for Australian consumers and companies? and exporters?
Well, it depends upon which kind of sector you're in, I guess, in terms of what the potential benefits might be. I think the Trans-Pacific Partnership has a huge reach in terms of, you know, the dozen countries that are involved at the moment cover a huge amount of the world's trade. So, you know, if it is a kind of a truly comprehensive agreement, there could be certainly benefits in terms of market access. But it's very hard to tell in the looking at the kind of the totality of the agreement what is actually in it at the moment. And we've had leaks from WikiLeaks in terms of certain chapters, but certain other chapters kind of remain dark to us and we don't really necessarily know what's in it thus far. And I guess that's going to be very kind of an important kind of issue when it comes to evaluating what are the benefits and costs of the agreement. The Productivity Commission in Australia has kind of warned that, you know, in the past, free trade agreements have been oversold. We've kind of talked up their benefits and have not necessarily been very hard-headed about their potential long-term risk.
Well, it's like Rob was saying about the free trade agreements between, say, you know, the US and Haiti with their rice exports, or even with us trying to get sugar to America.
Yeah, so I think it's really important that we have some sort of independent assessment of free trade agreements. I mean, back with the Australia-United States Free Trade Agreement, the Senate Select Committee had Philippa Dee, an economist, do a kind of report on some of the impacts. But at the moment, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade are in a very kind of strange position of both being, you know, an advocate of the agreement and then, you know, are really kind of defending it when it kind of comes up for parliamentary review. But, you know, in certain jurisdictions, there's going to be a great deal of scrutiny of the trade agreement. So in the United States, President Barack Obama needs a fast-track authority from the United States Congress if he's going to get it through Congress. And what's been very striking has been that, you know, 151 US Democrats in the House of Representatives have said that they don't want to give Obama a fast-track authority. So his own party has kind of expressed deep concerns about the lack of consultation with Congress about the content of the agreement. The effect of that means that, you know, if Obama doesn't have a fast-track authority, Congress can then go through the whole agreement and work out what they like and what they don't like. So that's kind of quite interesting. A number of the US congressmen and women like Rosa DeLauro and Henry Waxman and Ron Wyden have been very concerned about the impact of the Trans-Pacific Partnership upon the environment and public health and consumer protection and financial regulation. And interestingly, at the same time, there are a score of Republicans, including, you know, Tea Party's Michelle Bachmann, who have also expressed concerns about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think they have much more concerned about investment clauses and really don't want to give Obama a win on anything. So I think President Barack Obama is in a very kind of curious position. You know, he's promoting a trade agreement that doesn't necessarily have the support of the United States Congress. And politically, it's going to be a bit like the House of Cards trying to get it through the United States Congress once the text is finalised. And I think that will be a very important and significant kind of challenge to, you know, whether or not the agreement kind of gets up.
I mean, I guess the other big concern for a lot of people is that, you know, big companies like Monsanto or Walmart or Amazon are advising the negotiations and essentially, I guess, looking after their commercial interests, you know, and I suppose for people concerned about GM food or, you know, retail being taken over by a big corporation, they're also, isn't there a bit of a conflict of interest there, having companies with a special interest in these kind of, you know, to have some kind of sovereignty over governments involved in the negotiations?
Well, the secrecy surrounding the Trans-Pacific Partnership has really allowed industry groups and multinational companies to have a great deal of influence on the kind of contents of the agreement. So, you know, and that's across a wide range of areas, but, you know, particularly notable in terms of something like the investment chapter or the intellectual property chapter, is certainly kind of designed with the long-term interests of transnational companies in mind. And I guess that is kind of controversial. I mean, in terms of some of the measures, there has been a lot of concern about companies trying to use the agreement to kind of frustrate reforms. So you mentioned Monsanto. You know, in the United States, there's been a big push by some states to have GM food labelling. And there's been a lot of debate about whether the Trans-Pacific Partnership would restrict the ability to engage in such labelling schemes. And there's been a lot of debate about, you know, how the agreement will affect biotechnology and biotechnology regulation. So I guess that is certainly a very kind of important kind of area. And similarly, there's also been quite a bit of concern about how some of the big food companies have been making a play in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So Professor Sharon Friel, my colleague at the Australian National University, held a really good conference on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and food and nutrition. And her concern was that, you know, the agreement might undermine things like food labelling and nutrition labelling.
Dr. Rimmer, we're going to have to wind up now. We're going into the news. Thank you so much.
Overnights with Sunil Badami on ABC Local Radio.